here we are, bringing back Keeping It Simple. We're on location at the Exchange in Miami, which is the ETF conference. And we are thrilled to be here. Paul Kim is joining me instead of my usual partner, Harley Bassman, who's given up on his inflation calls. And we're actually bringing in Bob Pisani, who is well known to CNBC viewers and almost everybody in the financial markets, to discuss financial markets as well as your new book, Bob.
And turning the tables, by the way. Yeah, interviewing you.
Yeah, it's a strange experience having a book out and actually having people ask me questions after 33 years at CNBC, where I ask most of the questions, but it's been enjoyable.
Well, let's make sure we keep it as a dialogue, so feel free to ask questions if you want to flip the tables. But maybe the first question, why would you start a book that starts out with shut up?
The people ask me about the title all the time. When the publisher bought the book, we had a discussion. They said, well, what do you want to call the book? What's the title? We need a title. And I said, well, I want to call it something like Lessons on Life and Investing for the Floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And immediately they said, that's not a title. That's a subtitle. We need a title. So tell us what the producers tell you while you're waiting to go on the air. You know, people are fascinated by the mechanics of television, how the sausage gets made, and how you have these IFBs in my ear that are hooked in. It's a wireless. It's hooked into the studio with the producers. And I said, well, the producers can say anything they want. Hi, Bob. You're up next. Carl tosses to you. You toss to Carl. But most of the time, they'll say some variation on the word rap, which means shut up, or the other word stretch, which means keep talking. So most of the time, you hear some variation on shut up and keep talking. And he said, that's it. That's the title. Shut up and keep talking. And that kind of explains what the title's about.
Fantastic. And the subtitle is actually Life Lessons on Investing from the New York Stock Exchange. Okay. So now, one of the things that was fun for me in reading your book, and one of the things I love about reading a book, is when it actually takes me back to a place. So I got my start trading on the floor for New York, for Spearley's and Kellogg, which is the largest specialist on the New York Stock Exchange. You do a wonderful job of reorienting the reader to that time period, right? When you were, the specialist firms were dominant, where it was very much a club that, as you highlight, nobody wanted to talk to you initially, right? It was very insular. What changed in that time period? First, as you became part of the club, and then as you actually had to say goodbye, basically, to all the people.
Well, Spear Leeds and Kellogg bring back a lot of memories because they were a very big firm on the floor. Peter Kellogg was a very big player, and that was the top of the market. Goldman Sachs bought Spear Lead Kellogg in 1999.
$5 billion.
That along with Herzog Hein Gedul being bought out by Merrill Lynch, as I recall. I think that was $900 million. That all happened within a couple months. And then Mike LaBranche decided to go public. He was one of the biggest specialists on the floor. Those three things happened within a couple of months. And that turned out to be the market top. The prices were very high for all of these things, including going public. So it was a big pivotal moment. So that Spearley's Kellogg bring back some interesting memories. What happened to the NYSE is a very good example of technological disruption. For 100 years, more than 100, 150 years, they had an open outcry method. And when I got there in late 96, early 97, there were 4,000 people on the floor, almost all men. And they did 80% of the volume in the New York Stock Exchange was conducted on the floor. Now, even in the mid-1990s, it was not completely open outcry. There was some electronic type trading allowed. There was a system called the Designated Order Turnaround System, DOT system, whereby an individual, say, on Merrill Lynch's trading desk could send an order directly to a specialist on the floor without having a floor broker involved. So there were some workarounds to open outcry. But by and large, there were people screaming on the floor at each other. And boy, 4,000 people on the floor, you should have been there for that. It was quite an experience because it was like a fraternity. It was a very, very privileged, elite group of people who were conducting most of the trading in New York, in the United States, essentially. NASDAQ was important, but on the floor, these guys reigned supreme. And what happened was two things. One is the pricing mechanism fell under attack. When I got there, it was trading in eighths. I mean, imagine trading in eighths. You know this. Yep. It's a pretty profitable business when your spread is 12 and a half cents. And then in 1997, it went to 16ths, 6 1/4 cents. And then finally in 2000 and 2001, it was a transitional period, it went to pennies. That helped destroy the profitability of the brokerage system overall. So that, number one. But number two is just the growth of electronic trading itself. Mechanisms existed. It was a perfect marriage of hardware and software. The hardware became fast enough the software became efficient enough to be able to match buy and sell orders in sub-second intervals. And this turned out to be something that enhanced trading, made trading more efficient, and enabled people to get execution a lot quicker. So when you're talking about sub-second intervals, you know, an order executed on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, even if rapidly in 1999, could take, you know, 10, 15, 20 seconds. That doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're dealing in sub-second intervals, that's a lot. And there was people arbitraging this difference out between floor-based trading and electronic trading that made a lot of money at that time. So there was a perfect series of technological displacement going on. There's price changes along with the birth of electronic trading. And eventually, the floor was at a disadvantage because there were people who were trading in electronic medium. There was a company called Archipelago. Mm-hmm. There were other ones that were out there. Yeah, Island, that were out there. And eventually, the New York Stock Exchange had to buy one of their competitors. They bought Archipelago and essentially ran a parallel operation. There was this electronic trading operation called Archipelago that the NYC owned, and they had the floor operation. And it was very awkward there. I was there for that. And they had to figure out a way to sort of meld that together. And there was a number of very, very awkward years that made it difficult. So by 2006, essentially what happened was the New York Stock Exchange, like all of them, was a mutual company, and they decided to essentially sell themselves to the public. And that created a real on top of the going to pennies, on top of the technological disruption of electronic trading, going public kind of dramatically changed the attitude and the mindset of what it was like to work on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. I personally, I believe that above all, you have to embrace change. You have to be able to embrace technological change, financial disruption. And so I'm glad that I saw that. I saw the New York Stock Exchange at the very height of its power, and the floor at the height of its power. And today, instead of 4,000 people doing 80% of the volume, there's 225 people that do 15 to 20% of the volume. That's technological disruption. Yeah.
It's right an extraordinary there. Change. And you mentioned the dynamics of open outcry, et cetera. You know, I had never physically met you before. You're a taller guy versus most people that we see on TV, et cetera. We used to actually recruit people to the floor. I'm 6'4", 240, right? So, you know, you would recruit people to the floor because of a combination of their size, their physicality, their voice, et cetera. It wasn't just enough to be smart. The other thing you mentioned is this idea that it was elite, right? It was elite in terms of it was a small club, but the people that were on the floor were anything but.
That's right. And a good example is Art Cashin, who was now is the head of floor trading for UBS. But was with Payne Weber at the time when I met him in the 90s. And Art Cashin never went to college. He came right out of high school. And a lot of the guys that I met there in the 90s, they never went to college. There was a path to a career on the floor. You started out as a runner, mm-hmm. where you literally, like the broker would hand a guy, you know, orders and go over there and make sure he gets the message over there. Literally, you're a runner. Mm-hmm. And there was a path to a career on the floor. That path doesn't exist anymore. But at the time, it was a real organization. And I'll tell you what, the moment that really changed everything, one of the privileges of having a seat at the New York Stock Exchange, literally there was a seat at one point, was you could bring in clients. And the luncheon club upstairs was a very elite, it was like the most elite luncheon club. I mean, Rockefeller had eaten there. J.P. Morgan, I mean, the real J.P. Morgan used to come. And it was a very storied club to get into. And they had luncheons and breakfasts. And then the bar was open in the afternoon. And these guys were legendary. They would brook no shit from anybody. They were drinkers and they were big eaters. And it was a big thing to get invited to have lunch, you know, with the specialists. You know, you had to have a big account, you know, to have a brokerage room and have, here's, you can have lunch with the broker upstairs at the luncheon club or breakfast. And in 2006, when the NYSE went public, they closed the luncheon club. And the reason they closed it is it's a loss leader. Yeah. It was a private club, essentially, that was run for the members, which were the people, the seat holders. And it didn't make any money. They didn't charge enough to cover all the people around it. It was the trading that made the money. So once it went public, it wasn't a private mutual company. You know, the people who were running the place looked at it and said, we got to close it. Well, that was very much a serious problem for morale on the floor. Art Cashin used to spend every afternoon after the close at the bar with what he called the Friends of Fermentation, FOF. I was one of them, frankly. And we'd sit and talk about the day. and drink scotch. And he picked up literally the day it happened, picked his glass up practically, walked across the street to Bobby Vann's, which is a steakhouse across the street, and decamped there from 2006 to the pandemic, to 2020. Bobby Vann's closed last year, but that's what happened. And sort of a lot of the camaraderie went away. But again, that's technological disruption. That's progress.
Well, it is progress, but it also, as you highlighted, so my experience in the New York Stock Exchange, by the way, my mother was a secretary. Her boss actually took a shine to me and basically said, I'm going to help you get a job on Wall Street with Spears and Kellogg. I started as a runner. The very first day that I'm on the exchange, the guy I'm clerking under, I'm the runner for a clerk, he speaks back to his executing broker, gets fired. The broker turns to me and says, you look like a smart kid. You think you can pass the test? And next thing you know, I'm
there
a clerk on the New York Stock Exchange.
There's a good example. I'm glad you told me that. See, there's the path to help people.
And that's one of the things that I find actually so distressing or frustrating. While I embrace the technological change, there's also a genuine loss of the ability to advance in this industry. I mean, I'm still sitting here now, you know, in my 50s. Most of the people, you mentioned Art Cash, and I've been fortunate enough to dine with him at Bobby Vann's, and you mentioned the New York Stock Exchange dining room. I remember actually dining there with Peter Kellogg, who loved to have Clamato, tomato juice
vodka.
with clam and a splash of vodka in there for his lunches.
That's well known.
So, you know, you had all of that change, and I agree with you, like the decimalization, like I got to tell you, the best traders out there, and I constantly remind people of this, the dealers know what's going on, right? So if Spearley is a Kellogg, if Peter Kellogg is selling to you, and if LaBranche is selling and everybody else is actually checking out, you know that the institution is about to change in a pretty significant way. So now that we look at the world that has become completely electronic, right, where effectively there is nobody who's actually involved in that process. One of the other big changes that happened, and it was a byproduct of that, is we moved from a system where there was a relationship between the specialist who had a contractual obligation to provide liquidity to the environment that we exist in today, where high-frequency trading firms have the opportunity but not the obligation. Right, so it's a little bit of a different game. It's not a multi-period component. I don't have to worry about, am I going to get fired by Morgan Guarantee, as Spearleads and Kellogg was in the crash of 87, for not making a market in their securities. They were actually fired by Morgan Guarantee. That was a huge black eye that Spearleads and Kellogg received. Today, nobody actually expects that. So when Facebook gaps down in an open outcry, in a electronic exchange, there's nobody there who is, quote unquote, responsible. Do you?
Well, yes and no. Okay. The obligations changed. The NYC changed the obligations of the specialists, too, in 2007, 2008. And they still, the specialists still have affirmative obligations to provide a two-sided market. I would say the rules around that are not the same as they were 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. About the market makers, Citadel, you've got Virtu, you've got GTS. These are people who stepped in the wake of the vacuum of what happened and what Reg NMS gave us. So look at what essentially happened. When they went to electronic trading, the question is, who gets the trade? What's the priority here? And what happened under Reg NMS and the SEC decided on what I call price time priority. Mm-hmm. So you have to provide the best price. You can't have it on other, you can't provide inferior pricing on other exchanges or other dark pools or other alternative trading systems. You have to provide the best price. But after that, suppose everyone has the best price. Well, then it's whoever gets there first. And that's why high-frequency trading came to exist. Mm-hmm. It came to exist because that is what the world they gave us. They said that's the priority. Therefore, well, obviously the first thing I got to do is provide the best prices. But after that, shit, there's a lot of other people out here providing good prices too. I got to get there faster. And that's when we had the co-location stories. That's when we had all of these crazy things. And everybody said, oh, these horrible people. And they said, they're not horrible people. They were given the playbook. Mm-hmm. This is what happens when you're given that playbook. Sub-second, microsecond, co-location, beat the guy there first because you're the one with the best prices. So I don't see these people as horrible or evil. I see them as looking at the playbook and saying, okay, how do we win this playbook? And that makes perfect sense, what they did.
It makes perfect sense. And actually, I remember very specifically, so I transitioned over to the buy side at that point, right? So I'm actually working as a portfolio manager for a firm called Royce & Associates. We went to do a field check on a company called Cogent Communications, which you've probably encountered at various points in time. the most valuable real estate in New York actually became co-location spaces.
That's right.
It was just extraordinary. You'd go to these sky rises that were right next to the exchanges, and they would be filled not with human beings, but with computers. Right, they were actually providing connectivity in that microsecond type framework that you're referring to.
Yeah. I'll tell you what's the more disturbing thing for me as a journalist covering this is the sort of lack of information that happens in a complete sub-second trading vacuum. So in the old days, the 1990s, when there were guys on the floor, and suddenly the markets started moving, and it wasn't necessarily obvious. I could walk on the floor, and I could go around, and I say, guys, what are you seeing here? Anything going on? And, you know, if you had people you trusted on the floor who would trust you, that you don't go on the air, start blabbing about individual people's business, which you don't do, you could talk to people and say, well, there's an awful lot of, you know, oil stocks putting up for sale here. And it seems like an awful lot of pharmaceutical stocks to buy here. You could get a tenor of the market. When they went to electronic trading, what happened was the buy side bitterly complained about the sell side being leaky, the information mm-hmm. being leaky. And in a sense, it always was. So if you're standing there on the floor and the Goldman Sachs guy is standing there all day hitting the bid on Pfizer, you know, this guy's got some size. Everyone saw it. So you could, and people knew this, and the buy side hated this. The Fidelities and the Vanguards, everybody hated it because they felt like people were watching this and it might affect the prices.
Right.
So when they had electronic trading and all of a sudden you could slice this into 100 share orders at a time. So instead of 100,000 shares of Pfizer to buy, you slice it into 1,100 share orders and push it through the day at the VWAP. They loved this. Because it's completely anonymous. Nobody knows anything. Here's the problem for that buy side. They still wanted to know what was going on in the market. So they would start spreading their business around to anybody and to try to get an edge. But nobody had that edge because everyone had the same thing. All you see in is 100 share orders of Pfizer, and what kind of story can you make out of this? There's no obvious, there's no Goldman Sachs guy standing there hitting the bid every mm-hmm. moment. So the buy side loved it because it provided anonymity, but they also had the same problem that I had, which is it's hard to figure out what's going on. So remember, today, your job is still, no matter what anybody tells you, you're a journalist. It's involved in a narrative, creating a story.
I think narrative is an important part, right? And perhaps technology has changed both the pace and source of narratives. Certainly media's had a similar technological arc, and you get different endpoints, and you have much more decentralized information sources, faster uptake. I feel like a lot of the narrative comes after the price moves now, right? So some press release or some FOMC minutes come out, AI reads it instantly, and the price immediately goes in. And then humans get to then shape the narrative, and a lot of it is a function of the price. So it's sort of like the sequencing has changed a little bit. So I think that's part of the challenge of the world we live today, where you're changing technology. You still want to be focused on storytelling and narratives, but now what's the role of humans? Is it confirming what the market's already gotten to in a split second, right? It's interesting. Yeah. You've seen some of that.
Well, if what you're pointing out is a fundamental feature of behavioral economics, which is that narrative can shape price. Robert Shiller wrote a book in 2000 called Irrational Exuberance, and there was an entire chapter devoted exactly to this, where he looked at the history of bubbles, for example, and found that prices, the markets can react immediately to a price of an event that will cause some price change, but then there are additional price changes that occur in the days following as the media and people write about the story, and the writing of that story can also affect the price. So it's exactly what you just said, so I'm agreeing with you, but I'm saying that this has been academically studied, and your observations are correct.
Well, and one of the dynamics associated with that is the actual price behavior itself can have any number of reasons behind it, right? So say, for example, the Fed releases its minutes, right? And the information is, as Paul points out, being read by an AI. Well, that AI can actually totally change its behavior based on the position of the firm that actually sponsored the AI, right? If they happen to be super long treasuries, then you're going to see a particular response. If they happen to be short treasuries going into the event, you could see a totally different response.
Yeah. When you say AI, though, you mean the algorithm that's being programmed.
The algorithm that is reading the actual release. Right. Because there is no capability within the microsecond components for us to be able to identify what is actually the intent, what's the tone, et cetera. You are increasingly using machine reading technology to identify the keywords that you've told it in advance you care about, right? So when you think about that loss, what used to be called the scuttlebutt, right? What's going on? Does that in turn affect the efficiency of the market, or do you think it never really mattered all that much and it was just a narrative?
I think if anything, the market is getting more efficient, not less efficient, and I like that. We can get into all sorts of academic. I went for a decade back and forth with all these people about efficient market hypothesis, and what I came to, and I said this in the book, and again, I'm not an academic. I just interview academics.
Yep.
My conclusion was the market is not perfectly efficient. We found that out with behavioral economics. And one of the things that Shiller talked about, this was 40 years ago, one of the first reasons he became famous was he did a study where he determined that, in theory, the stock market should move on fundamentals. It should move on some aspect of expectation for a dividend, earnings, and then some multiple that you're putting on, the P-E ratio, which is how much you're willing to pay for that future stream of earnings. And what he found was that the volatility of the stock market cannot be completely explained by fundamentals, that there is an additional component of volatility in the market, which he concluded was associated with some irrational elements of investing. That is hard to explain, but is clearly evident. And that's sort of the birth of behavioral economics, right? That was over 40 years ago when he made that observation. So I think it's very real. So my attitude on this whole thing is the markets are not perfectly efficient, but they're efficient enough. They're efficient enough so that it's very, very difficult to get outperformance anymore. And it's not because investors are stupid, quite the opposite. You look at people who've examined this closely, like Charlie Ellis, who wrote Winning the Loser's Game, and his conclusion was it's the investment community is not stupid, it's extremely smart. And they're all so good now, and we have access to the same information, that it's very difficult to provide any outperformance. And it's only when you may get large amounts of uninformed investors, often associated with retail, that you can get some potential outperformance. And I think that's an absolutely true observation. I think Wall Street's brilliant. You know, we like to make fun of people saying,
can't outperform the S&P.
Yeah, amateur stock pickers are terrible stock pickers, but professional stock pickers are terrible. And that happens to be true, but it's not true because they're stupid. It's true because they're brilliant, and they all have access to the same information. Very interested to discuss AI and how this is going to change things. And you didn't ask me, but I'll give you my 20 seconds on this. Just like the market got very smart in the last 20 years with information being able to exchange very, very quickly, and humans interpreting it quickly, and now bringing in machine learning to interpret it quickly, and everyone now has sort of a level playing field to a certain extent. I think this is going to happen with AI too. So you're going to have some bridge here where there will be people who have some informational advantages because they have better AI. And this has happened in the past. You know, James Simons, I mean, the quant guys out there 20 years ago were noticing relationships that nobody noticed because they had data analysis that was really good. Mm-hmm. The one I always like to say is, like, you know, what's the relationship between the wheat crop in Nebraska and the S&P 500? Mm-hmm. There's no relationship, right? Well, but quants can say there is a statistically valid relationship. Yeah. And I say, why is there a relationship between the wheat crop in Nebraska and the S&P 500? That doesn't make any sense.
Lunar cycles, too.
And they look at me, a true quant, I've had these conversations, will say, I have no idea, maybe you know, but all I know is there's a statistically valid relationship. And to a quant, that's enough. They don't need to know why. And so people like Simons uncovered relationships that were not obvious. It's quant analysis is just studying relations between numbers. They don't care what the numbers are. They're just looking for valid signals. And I think that you will very quickly see some people who are making stunning amounts of money using various amounts of more sophisticated AI, but that it will very quickly level out as the AIs sort of level out against each other. That's my guess of what would happen.
I think that's probably right. I mean, it's a constant arms race, right? And so you make advances, the next person makes advances. And I'd go a step further and actually say, if Renaissance believes that there's a statistically valid relationship between wheat crops and the S&P, and they deploy capital against that trade, it's going to make it more and more and more true. That correlation, that relationship will get stronger because it's being reinforced by the market participants until it gets to the point that it actually has been overinterpreted in the signals, and then it'll start to flip.
If enough people believe in it, this is sort of the origin of technical analysis.
Correct. That's exactly right. So you ultimately are looking at that dynamic. And it's one of the things that I think is so interesting, and it's one of the concerns that I have, which is, as we've moved away from the study of the fundamentals and assuming that the price effectively is derived from the fundamentals, which any specialist knows is really not true, right? It's positioning and books. It's I receive an inflow of capital of $100 million that I need to deploy, and guess what? I'm going to put it in basically the same things that are in my portfolio already that can cause that type of price perturbation, leading everyone to say, well, what's going on? What's the fundamental, right? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, Goldman Sachs showing up with a ton of shares to buy for Fidelity or somebody else, right? So as we move further and further to that point where effectively all we're studying is price, because that's the most frequently observed piece of information, one of the key risks is that we actually lose sight of the fundamentals. The idea that markets are supposed to allocate and set a cost of capital for that next dollar that actually needs to go in for investment, or that next dollar that needs to be issued in terms of an IPO or a secondary issue, a company raising capital, et cetera. We've seen that chaos in the past couple of years where companies that are bankrupt have been able to issue shares, all sorts of crazy stuff. How do you on CNBC, like, how do you keep a straight face when you watch some of this happening, right? Whether it's, you know, the behaviors of the GameStops, et cetera, the AMCs, like, these have to be, well, difficult for you on occasion, having been through these cycles.
And I'll tell you, on one level is, I don't have the luxury of being able to stand up and say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I think this is a lot of baloney.
Yep.
Back to you, Sue.
Yeah.
On the one level, I'm a journalist, and I have to report the news. So if there's a new ETF out that's a cybersecurity ETF, you know, we've seen this before, and, you know, we probably know they're buying at the top, and this is going to be a problem. But I have to report the news and what's going on. Now, I may have a guest on who will point out, you know, these stocks are going to, they're buying them at the top right here. This is going to be a problem. I'll be happy to have somebody on to have that perspective. But I can't be too ideological about all of this. I have to report what the news is and what's going on. So let's just talk about the meme stocks, okay? Mm-hmm. So the minute this happened with GameStop, and people were messaging me and say, so Bob, does this mean fundamental analysis doesn't matter anymore? Isn't that what it means? And I said, look, what do you get when you get a stock? What do you buy? What's the purpose of owning a stock? I go back to real fundamentals. I do a little bit of history on this. The very first stock, modern stock, the Dutch East India Company, 1602, they had the spice trade to India and to the East Indies. And what did, in their prospectus, they told you what you get if you buy our stock. They said, we are going to take the profits, we are going to take the spices that come off the ships, we're going to sell them on the open market, and we're going to distribute the profits to the shareholders. Well, there it is. They're telling you right there what they're going to do. You are getting a future stream of earnings. Later, they had dividends, too. And so there's the birth of fundamental analysis. The very first stock, they tell you, we're distributing the profits to the shareholders. And I am at a loss to explain why there are other reasons to own stocks these days. Now, it is perfectly true that you can get stocks that are divorced from their fundamentals. We had people in the 1990s, you've been around a long time, I don't know if you remember Arch Crawford. Arch Crawford used to make stock predictions based on astrology. The moon totally is in Venus, we're going to buy Microsoft. And we'd like look at him like, really? But there were people who followed this.
Yep.
There was a whole debate. We've had endless debates about technical analysis. The academic evidence is very mixed to down on technical analysis, that it doesn't work long term. And yet, tell this to people who believe in it, they'll start screaming at you. There is a strong group of adherence to this. So what do you do here? How do you approach something like Oh, GameStop means fundamental analysis, doesn't matter anymore. Well, if you can get enough people to suddenly believe that sunspots will predict, you know, movements in Microsoft, and you can get enough of them to do that, you can affect the behavior of that stock, irrespective of the fundamentals. And I think that happened in a lot of circumstances. And all I can say is, that's fine, but if you think it's suddenly you found a way to completely upend 500 years of investing in stocks, I don't think so.
So let's take that a little bit. Your career almost perfectly arches over the formation of the U.S. ETF market, and you've been a big advocate and education provider, right, on ETFs, whether it's through yourself or through interviews. You probably have impacted the ETF market indirectly yourself. Any observations there, any stories where you think you actually impacted history?
Me personally, well, I was very proud of the fact that I did the very first moment when the gold ETF started in 2004, and the World Gold Council was, I called them, they were going to start trading on the floor, and I said, they were the sponsor, and I said, this is a big thing, because people are going to be able to buy gold now, and the gold's in the vault in London, and you're going to be able to hold it, you're the custodian, you charge 40 basis, this is, you know, I think an important moment, because given the carrying costs and the cost of gold, people who want to believe in the gold story. Again, I didn't make any judgment about gold, whether it's nonsense or not, and whether it's a hedge against inflation. People want to own gold. This is a more efficient vehicle for them to own gold. I said, I want you guys coming on the floor. I want you to bring a bunch of gold bars. I want you to bring some big, burly guys, and let's do a whole thing. And they said, we'd love to, but we're not coming. We can't. I said, why not? What's the problem? He said, well, we're not sure the lawyers will let us promote the ETF. I said, what do you mean? It's going public. And he said, they were very worried that it would sound like the SEC would sue them for touting. Yep. I said, you guys got to get new lawyers. And he said, and they didn't come. I said, I want a favor from you. I want you to give me gold. And they brought gold from the vaults in with two big guards. And this is a very famous picture of me holding the gold bar up saying, do it. Now, that didn't affect trading, of course. But it shows how, as a journalist, I don't have an opinion on gold. I'm not there to tout my ideas on gold. This is an important development because a lot of investors were interested in that. I'll tell you very quickly what I think about ETFs. First, I'm an index guy by and large. I know about all the other ways of adding value. Value, small caps can outperform. But by and large, I'm by and large an index guy. Ever since Bogle, and Jack Bogle was the biggest influence in my life, meeting him in 1997 changed my life. And he helped open my eyes. He was quite insistent that CNBC was spending too much time with superstar investors, like Bill Miller from Legg Mason. He would always say, you know, he's a fine gentleman, but these people are very rare, and they don't outperform for long periods. There is mean reversion. He was very professorial. He talked like Jack Bogle. You know, I didn't realize it then, but he talked like Jack Bogle. And he said, you've got to emphasize, Bob, that these people come and go. There's nothing wrong with them, but they just come and go. And you've got to keep people on a steady path of investing. Don't let them trade too much. They make mistakes. And he was just very pleasant but professorial with me. Like, you don't get it, Bob. You know, this is the mantra of Vanguard. And eventually, I came to believe that. And what was beautiful about the ETF structure, it offered a low-cost vehicle for that initially, more tax efficient. You all know about that. Here's the problem I have with ETFs. Because very quickly, a lot of the money that wanted to be in the indexing got soaked up, the industry had to keep expanding because it became a big business. And so there has been the creation of what I call, you know, ETF flavor of the month stuff. And I've gone through many, many things. Pot ETFs, you know, attempts for Bitcoin ETFs, thematic ETFs, cybersecurity, social media ETFs. And what happens here, I fear, and this is the Jack Bogle in me, is so social media is suddenly a hot topic 5 years ago. And of course, social media ETFs get floated. And you're buying at the top. So they create the ETF at the top. And then there's underperformance years later because it's a popularity contest. Guys, we're in the business. People want to buy social media ETF.
Package a product for them.
I'm going to package a product and give it to them. Yep. It's Wall Street. What, is anybody shocked to hear this? But people ought to understand what happens. You're buying at the top. You're creating a fund, buying stuff, putting it in there at the top. And it underperforms. There was a study that's coming out from the University of London that's out this week. They did a whole bunch of studies on this and found that the thematic type ETFs tend to underperform in the years following, because not because they're stupid, or not even because they're charging too much. Not the price so much. It's because they're buying at the top because of the nature of the ETFs. And that's a problem. And there I can see Jack Bogle looking down on you saying, Bob, you don't get it. You're doing that social media ETF or the cybersecurity ETF, and you know there's going to be mean reversion on this. And that bothers me. But again, I'm a journalist. I'm going to stand here and editorialize every time. I'm going to cover if there's a new social media ETS. I'm going to cover it. I'm going to have the guys on. I'm going to say this, and I might bring on somebody on and say, are we buying at the top here with this? So you see what my responsibilities are. I have to cover the news.
Absolutely. So you said a couple of things that I thought were fascinating. First, you brought up the gold ETF, which was a huge impact. And one of the things that that actually did was it opened up the opportunity for people to own gold directly. Historically, if you'd wanted to own gold, you either had to physically make your way down to a jewelry store or to a coin dealer and buy bars. You could potentially source it from a bank if you happened to bank with a Swiss bank. But ultimately, if you wanted to buy it in a pseudo-liquid form, you had to go through a Vancouver Exchange-listed junior gold mining company that was supposedly going to produce tons of gold and provide you a proxy to gold while at the same time introducing a unprofessional management team whose objective was basically to take your money, right? So you actually saw this quite materially with the listing of the gold ETF. You began to see a derating of all the gold stocks. And it almost can date to exactly that point, right? That was the date at which gold stocks began to underperform significantly versus the metal as quoted in commodity form. So it was like, that's a perfect example of one of
disruption.
The ways that you can disrupt it, that you can introduce things and correctly by introducing direct access to the underlying metal. It took away a premium that had existed if I offered access to it through an easily traded equity, right? The second thing that you just said that I thought was actually really fascinating was you said he talks like Jack Bogle, right? Jack Bogle was marketing, right? He may have actually had good intentions and he may have very well believed what he was saying, but he absolutely was marketing. And so the question I guess I would ask you is, why are the rules different for Vanguard in that perception versus anybody else?
I don't think they are different. Yeah. And when you say he's marketing, yes, but Jack Bogle ran a mutual fund company, yes, but he was marketing an ideology, and that's what was different. Yes, of course he has Vanguard funds and he markets Vanguard, but he marketed an ideology, and it was a way, and I mean, it's hard to describe to people who don't understand it how hated he was in the industry. People didn't want anything to do with an S&P 500 fund. Remember the arguments. We don't want to go with the market. We want to beat the market. There's no money in this to float this thing. We can't charge fees around it. This was the argument about the ETF fund. The SPY, SPY, had trouble getting floated because people didn't want it. The industry couldn't figure out ways to make money off of it. So Bogle's attitude was very simple. The evidence is that most investors are better off in low-cost index funds. He knew immediately, and he always knew, that there were people who wanted to beat the market. He was not an ideologue in that sense. He knew that there was a substantial group, minority people, that wanted to try to beat the market, and he was instrumental in the creation of actively managed funds like Capital Opportunities at Vanguard. And his whole point about active management is keep the costs low, because what he saw was any active manager who ever outperformed for more than a few years got the alpha destroyed because the fees were too high. There was Bogle's central insight. So even active management, he was not against active management. He felt most people should be in passive funds, but he said active management, fine, keep it low cost. So I'm not sure what you're saying when you say Vanguard should be different. Vanguard is different in that their founding ideology was, I think, different than most other funds.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because when you ultimately talk about it, what he's describing there is outperformance by that particular ideology. I would argue that Cathie Wood has the same ideology, right? She just has a different approach to it. She may charge differently, but it's the same underlying philosophy that she's trying to outperform by pursuing a particular approach.
Well, Bogle would argue, with the S&P 500, Cathie Woods is trying to outperform in a specific subsector of the market. Bogle would say that she's picking a subsector and going with that. He's just arguing his broad outlines was to stay with the market. So, yes, Cathie Woods has an ideology for sure, and I think the ideology, we could talk about Cathie Wood if you want, but the disruptive technology is correct. By and large, you do want to go with companies that are engaging in some kind of disruption in their industry. That's for sure. So she's right. I think where she's faltered is disagreement over the price. So you can, again, it all gets down to, I agree with you, but how much am I paying for this? And what we saw when she became big in 2000 was people really overpaid. And the minute interest rates go up, you know what happens in growth stocks when interest rates go up, on a competitive basis, they get killed. So I don't think she's wrong. Cathie Wood is wrong ideologically. I completely agree with her. The issue is, what are we paying for these stocks?
Yeah, I think there's that component, but I mean, ultimately, Vanguard's paying the same prices for those stocks because they're embedded in the index as well, right?
Yes, but again, you can argue about whether subsectors or sectors are valued fairly or overvalued at this point. I mean, I get people screaming at me every day that the S&P is stupidly overvalued right now. It's something like 18.5 times 2023 earnings, and that's not a recessionary multiple. That's a growth multiple. Mm-hmm. So I get people arguing with me on that all the time. But yes, you seem to be want to argue that Cathie Wood and Jack Bogle are the same. And I know, other than the fact that both feel very strongly about what they're representing, I'm not sure Cathie Wood's investment ideology is the same as Jack Bogle's.
Well, it's definitely different, right? I mean, they're definitely different. But he was prosecuting an ideology in the same way that she was prosecuting, right? So the ideology is ultimately, you could be right, you could be wrong, but ultimately they're both marketing that ideology and pursuing that ideology. I think it's, to me, this is one of the components that is actually quite unique, right? So what Vanguard has actually done has created conditions under a regulatory framework in which everybody is pushed into passive vehicles, right? So 401ks now default into passive vehicles. Right, that's the selection.
My 401k seems to have a lot of actively managed stuff in it. In fact, I'm kind of surprised.
Are you restricted at all as an employee of CNBC from owning individual stocks?
I always have been. I can't own individual stock. I can own my company stock, which was General Electric originally because they own NBC, and now it's Comcast. I can own Comcast stock, but not other stock. I can own mutual funds and ETFs.
And is there a restriction? Could you buy Cathie Woods, for example?
I could buy ARK. Yeah, that's an ETF.
You could buy ARK as an ETF. Yes. Okay. So one of the things that you see is for most Americans, there was the introduction of what's called the Qualified Default Investment Alternative in 2006 as part of the Pension Protection Act. That actually created conditions under which corporations that are offering 401ks have liability associated with what's offered under their 401k. Now, Comcast may have a very generous 401k plan, but increasingly people are directed into target date funds where Vanguard's market share is approaching 65% and they exclusively invest in Vanguard funds. This is actually creating conditions within the industry that accessing that new flow of capital is almost impossible for anybody other than Vanguard.
Well, I know that Vanguard definitely has the lion's share of target date funds. So I don't know, is your argument that we need more people competing with the target date funds?
So I'd actually argue that we're beginning to cross over into two separate components. One is that we're beginning to approach thresholds, certainly when you have a 65% market share in a product that is liability protected within a 401k framework. That creates conditions under which you actually really should be examining the market power components of it, right? Is Vanguard basically doing that? Is there a competitive market for target date funds? Is part of the question.
I think that's an interesting question. I don't have a clear answer for you, but there's a reason that they became a dominant player. They were probably first to market, number one, with that.
Well, they were actually behind Fidelity on their life cycle funds, but the primary component, you're correct. I mean, what Vanguard has done better than anyone else is consistently hewed to the low-cost philosophy. Right? That part I absolutely love. It's certainly something that Paul and I embrace. The funds that we try to offer are discounts to most of the other products that are out there. We're actually offering many products that in some cases are cheaper on a leverage adjusted basis, for example, than Vanguard. That, I think, has actually absolutely been an extraordinary innovation. I think the thing that worries me is that you were effectively crowding into the same trade, right? We're all moving into the same component, and particularly as it relates to things like target date funds. Effectively, the only question that's being asked anymore is, do you have a job and how old are you? Right? Those don't seem like robust questions to ask within financial planning.
What are you
planning.
Suggesting that people should have a, I'm not sure where you're going with this, but no. should there be more questionnaires, like you're buying an options, and when if you're in a Schwab account, you want to buy options, they'll say, or do you understand what it is you're doing?
I think it's actually really hard to know what the right answer is. My concern is that we're asking markets to do what they're not designed to do, right? Markets are not designed to deliver retirement to people. Markets are designed to price the marginal cost of capital to facilitate capital allocation. And so when you have a condition under which the primary play...
You don't like target date funds, or you don't like Vanguard's dominance in target date funds?
Combination of the two. I think there's a lack of genuine innovation in the space and in the industry that is actually potentially going to lead to significantly adverse outcomes.
Okay. I'm not sure I agree with that at all, but I think that the idea of more diversity... or more competition in the retirement fund market is certainly a good thing.
Yeah.
So I would support that idea.
Yeah. No, I mean, that honestly is the core point that I would make, which is that I think, you know, a lot of the theories and a lot of the frameworks that we approach grew out of a view of a market that was largely efficient, largely competitive, had extremely high elasticity. And all of that makes sense when the largest player in the market's maybe 1% market share. We're now looking at a situation where you basically have to aggregate all the passive and all the index funds together to calculate the market share. It's approaching 45% for the total market. It's north of 65%, as I mentioned, for Vanguard and target date funds, which now capture 85% of each incremental dollar going into retirement accounts. Like, these are highly, highly concentrated strategies.
Yeah, so the narrative of chasing investments that are lowest in fees inadvertently has led to the change of cost of capital for companies and
Correct.
Industries, which has led to change in actual real world supply demand, oil, energy.
Is this the solution? Is this a problem in search of a solution? What your point here is what? That we need to have less people invested in index funds?
I think it's going back to the original comment that we're talking about. Everything is about narratives, and sometimes narratives take a lot longer to disprove or, you know, get crowded. And we should have more people asking the question, is the role of passive and cost-driven investing also a narrative that needs to be at least considered? Are regulations inadvertently creating a situation for much worse outcome later? Is it creating adverse conditions for, you know, proper allocation of capital? Are we all worse off because we're trying to be better in one aspect of our lives?
I'm in favor of that, as long as it's not a front for active managers to scream about their continuing shrinkage of their influence and their profit margin shrinking. As long as it's not a front for that,
I think that's an incredibly important observation, and I do think that that is actually one of the key challenges. Is that, you know, anyone who actually is going to spend the time learning and investing in the markets to develop the body of knowledge that would allow you to critique it, by definition, is trying to sell you something else, right? I mean, the world's smallest violin is playing for various fund managers around the world. We all have extraordinarily generous lives, and we have, we're very privileged in a way that those that many others are not. Yes. So when you think about what happens next, right? You've watched this evolution, and you think about the dynamics of how the New York Stock Exchange has changed. We've seen it move more towards an automated system. Do you think the AIs are the next? Do you think we're truly going to strip human beings from this process? Or do you think that something else is going to happen?
No. People have been saying the machines are taking over for 20 years. And I always say, you know, that's really lazy to say. I do not know any artificial intelligences that own stock. I know people that own stock. I know pension funds that own stock. I don't know any artificial intelligences that do that. I know there are algorithms that are invented and created by humans that will trade stock. And I know these algorithms are constantly being tinkered with by humans. But I don't see any artificial intelligence. It is lazy to say the machines are taking over. It is silly. One of the reasons I continue to support the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, even though the floor is 15%, 20% of the volume now, is because it's important for the public to believe that there are still human beings sitting around watching the stock market. Mm-hmm. And that's literally what they do. In fact, that's what I do. My main job is sit around, watch the stock market, and make comments about it. And I'm like the specialist. I got a big screens up in my office, and I sit there, and I walk on the floor if I see something weird, and I ask anybody know what's going on here? And so they're sitting there. And I think it's important for the public to know that people are still watching. Let's all just remember, there aren't any artificial intelligence that own stock. It's humans that own stock.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point, that the human fallibility is ultimately driving the programming behind the AI that supposedly is infallible, right?
Yeah, a bad algorithm is it doesn't exist because the algorithm did it. It exists because it didn't interact well, or they were wrong, or it was just poorly executed. Now, one thing will be very interesting to see how AIs write code more efficiently and write algorithms more efficiently. But again, you're going to be in an arms race with other AIs, and that tends to even out. I saw the margins in 1999. I could see these guys that were setting up like Island, these ATSs, and I could see them trying to arb out the S&P floor trading futures and the S&P electronic trading. And you'd think that prices would be the same. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same product. And yet, there were tiny differences. And they saw that immediately. And the people who were there first, I mean, a lot of money was made.
Yep.
Between 97 and 2000, 2001. I mean, I saw it and I went, wow.
This is part of it. I mean, one of the
and that
wrinkles
quickly,
in there.
Quickly
yeah,
compressed.
Closed. Yeah. And there was a lot of, by the way, one of the things I loved about the way that you described that and the SOES bandits, dynamics, et cetera, that played a role there, the regulatory framework that was designed to give equal access to small investors. We saw a replay of that in crypto, right? Where same thing, different exchanges, arbed across the exchanges, et cetera. Do you think that crypto is distinct and different? Do you think that there's an innovation that's occurring there that deserves more attention than it's getting?
I'll tell you the problem I have with crypto. So what everyone has a new asset class. I say, well, what does an asset class do for you? Does it help your returns? Does it lower your volatility? I mean, isn't that a fundamental thing to ask about a new asset class? Am I going to make more money? And is it going to lower my volatility, you know, somehow tamp down something? What's it going to do for me? So I look at, like, the returns here, and it looks kind of screwy to – you know, bet on Bitcoin as any kind of regular return mechanism. It's just
too
crazy.
Yeah.
And then I look like, is it going to reduce volatility? No, sure not. So I have a hard time arguing about it as an asset class. I'll tell you what I like. I really like blockchain. I am a big bull on blockchain because if that's not a disruptive technology potentially, I don't know what is. That thing has the potential to dramatically reduce financial friction in stock trading, in real estate transactions, sending money to your friend in London. I think blockchain, smart contracts, I'm a total bull on this. I'm completely neutral on Bitcoin, which is a cryptocurrency running off blockchain, because it has no intrinsic value. So therefore, I collect rock posters. I collect old 60s rock posters, and it's, you know, Jimi Hendrix at the Fillmore, and I love it. The posters are on the hang on my wall, but what do? They don't do anything. They don't give me a dividend. They don't have a future stream of earnings that I can throw off. It's a collectible. It's worth what anybody will pay me last time. Maybe there's a small community that kind of knows what it's worth roughly, but who knows? Bitcoin is kind of the same way. So I don't have any particular opinion on the price of Bitcoin. If you feel that it's important to trade it, go ahead. But on a fundamental basis, I've got no opinion at all on it. So, and people seem kind of disappointed about that. But I look at the technology. Mm-hmm. It's the technology that's really wonderful. Other than that, I have a hard time with the get-rich-quick thing around Bitcoin, and a hard time with the fact that it's used by large criminal organizations around the world. What percentage of Bitcoin transactions are criminal transactions? Really big, mm-hmm. really large.
All right. Getting away from Bitcoin, let's come full circle back to your book and wrap up. It was a great book, collection of great stories, great personalities, a lot of history, and plenty of investment observations and anecdotes. What made you write the book? What do you hope to get out of it? Will we see more?
The purpose of the book was, this is my 33rd year at CNBC, and that is a little unusual. Most people and journalists don't last that long in one place. CNBC is a wonderful place to work. It's very steady leadership. It's part of a big company. It's profitable. It's got a good profile. It's congenial place to work. And I combine that with the New York Stock Exchange. I don't work for the NYSE, but it's a wonderful institution to work in. And what you get is you get 10,000 bell ringings on the floor since I came there in 1997. And what do you see when you do that? If you stay at one place long enough, you've been a long time at this, mm-hmm. you start thinking, what do I know? It's fairly unusual to stay this long. Yeah. Well, what do I know? Do I know anything? Or am I just some bubble-headed TV reporter like the print guys think you are? No, and you do actually know something, and how do you organize it and shape it? So I decided to shape it around the New York Stock Exchange. And again, literally, I did the numbers. There's like 10,000 bell ringings I've seen. And the publisher said, what we want from you is, we don't necessarily need a financial history, but we want you interacting with financial history. You have a very unusual perch down there. Mm-hmm. You've met all these celebrities. We want to hear celebrity stories. Tell us about Robert Downey Jr. and what he told you. And they love that kind of stuff. Everyone just loves celebrity stories. And tell us about the historical changes you saw. And tell us about what people said to you on the floor and when the market dropped in 2000, and what was 9/11 like? I was out front of the buildings then. What was that like? And so I think I have something to convey about this and about fundamentals of investing. And I obviously show my hands, my cards here, about how I feel about long-term investing. And so the question comes down to, you're inch wide, mile deep. You know an awful lot about a little subject that's called the stock market. And do you feel you can help anybody and explain it? And it's been a wonderful run. Let me tell you, I'm very lucky to have worked at CNBC and very lucky to be on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and to see it at its very height. And I believe in what I'm doing. I love Wall Street. Most importantly, I like helping people with their retirement. People, you know, I go to brokers and I say, what do you guys do? What are you business are you in? They say, well, we're in the business of, we buy and sell stocks. I said, yeah. In a broader sense, though, look at it this way. We're in the dreams business. That's what we're all in. All of us. And I cover you guys. We're in the business of helping people realize their dreams. And instead of thinking, I just buy and sell stocks, actually, you know, you're helping people put their kids through college. You're helping people retire in Connecticut. You're in the dreams business. And when you look at it that way, it's not like, oh, we're just here to sell shit to people. That's all. It's just a big con game. It's not. It's a very serious business. It's about the dreams business.
And to wrap it up, I just wanted to say, like, for me, the dynamic of a book is, can it transport me to a place? And the thing that I loved was you brought me back to a place that I spent a lot of time that I loved, and your love for the institution, your love for what you're trying to convey to people, and honestly, the honesty and sincerity of your message to people, the importance of investing, how it can influence dreams, as you just said, comes through clearly. I love the book. Thank you so much for joining us, Bob. It's a real pleasure.
Mike, thank you very much. Paul, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Simplify Asset Management, Inc. is a registered investment advisor. Advisory services are only offered to clients or prospective clients where Simplify Asset Management, Inc. and its representatives are properly licensed or exempt from licensure. SEC registration does not constitute an endorsement of the firm by the commission, nor does it indicate that the advisor has attained a particular level of skill or ability. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and/or tax professional before implementing any strategy. This website and information are not intended to provide investment, tax, or legal advice. This content is solely for informational purposes and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. These materials are made available on an as-is basis without representation or warranty. The information contained in these materials has been obtained from sources that Simplify Asset Management, Inc. believes to be reliable, but accuracy and completeness are not guaranteed. This information is only current as of the date indicated and may be superseded by subsequent market events or for other reasons. Neither the author nor Simplify Asset Management, Inc. undertakes to advise you of any changes in the views expressed herein. Past performance is no guarantee of future returns. Investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Unless otherwise noted, any performance returns presented in these materials reflect hypothetical performance. Hypothetical strategies and indices presented are unmanaged, do not reflect any fees, expenses, transaction costs, commissions, or taxes, and one cannot invest directly in any of these. The results presented should not be viewed as indicative of the advisor's skill and do not reflect the performance results that were achieved by any particular client. During this period, the advisor was not providing advice using this model, and clients' results may have been materially different. Hypothetical model results have many inherent limitations, some of which, but not all, are described herein. One of the limitations of hypothetical performance results is that they are generally prepared with the benefit of hindsight. In addition, hypothetical trading does not involve financial risk, and no hypothetical trading record can completely account for the impact of financial risk in actual trading.